This is a new episode of Educar con Sentido, a series of conversations about education and society in these times of COVID-19 that we have to live right now. And with my colleague Ezequiel from the NGO Fara Digital, we want to welcome you, Professor Julian Sefton-Green. Julian is a professor of new media education, currently working at Deakin University in Melbourne, but you have also a very long tradition and trajectory of working and doing research and teaching in many universities around the world, and especially in Europe. So it's really a pleasure to have you here, Julian. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, just to start asking you, how are you doing? How are you? And how have been this year and a half? And I think that you have been living half in Australia and in London. How has been this experience?
So, yeah, I guess in my own very small privileged way, I've got my own story to contribute, which is that I was living, myself and my partner, we were living in Australia and we were there for 4 years and I've been working there full time. And then when the pandemic started, it was kind of uncertain to know what was happening, because as you remember, your people watching will remember, although we know what the facts are now, it was very unclear back in 2020, in February, March, what was happening, whether there was a pandemic and how serious it was and whether it would affect me as a person. But anyway, we decided to come back to London, where I was born and where I grew up and where my mother is and my son. And we decided to come back, not because I think we were worried about what was happening, but because we thought if we didn't come back, then we might not be able to come back. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the funny things about the pandemic, or funny is perhaps the wrong word, that it's not, for many people, it hasn't affected them materially, but it's affected their horizons of possibility. So you can't plan in the same way. You haven't got a future. You can't make a decision. You haven't got the same kind of choices. Now, I'm not saying that my circumstances are severe or problematic, but it means that I came back to England last March, and now I have no idea when I can go back to Australia. So I'm working full time for the university in Australia, which sometimes means I have to keep funny hours. But sometimes it's good, because I'm now much more in connection with the colleagues and friends in Europe and North America. The time zones are slightly more conducive to collaboration. But it means I can't plan when I'm going to go back. And the kind of world that I was lucky enough to live in, which is one of the academic privilege, where I would move between different universities, different countries for projects, it's not possible to do that in the same kind of way. And all the empirical projects that I've got are very complex to develop and implement, because obviously it's much more difficult to do practical empirical inquiry when you can't be physically present with people. So there are a number of ways in which my personal life has been confused more than usual, and a number of ways in which the work that I do has changed dramatically. On the other hand, what I would say is that on one level, I've spent the whole of the previous, 35 years researching and learning about learning outside of school, researching and learning about how we might, what education might mean more broadly than simply accreditation and qualifications in schools. So in some ways, the kind of work that I do has suddenly become important to everybody, because the idea of digitally mediated communication, the idea of forms of education that could not take place in a school, are now challenges that all education systems should be trying to deal with. And I say should because, and we can perhaps come back to this later, I don't think many countries in the world have really embraced the chance. And because in some ways the COVID pandemic has exposed some very unpleasant truths about what social function education performs in our societies.
Yeah. Finally, we need to admit that learning is outside schools, right? It can be in our phones.
I think there are two, for me, there are two ways of thinking about this. From a individualistic, a learning focus, which is not always which is one perspective. We can see how other kinds of learning, other forms of teaching, other forms of peer support offer really different opportunities. And there are ways in which some forms of education have become more efficient under the pandemic, not less efficient. On the other hand, and I think this would be the point that I care most about, there are aspects to being educated which are all about growing up in society and of collegiality and of mutuality, of friendship, of care, of sociality, all of these things. That has really shown up what school does that people didn't know that it did. And we live in a time where the ideology of education is only about individualism, about individual academic attainment, and not about other values. And the pandemic has really brought home to people the wider social functions that schooling performs in society. So I'm not naive about the attitudes changing processes towards learning, but the philosophy of education, the politics of education have been radically disrupted by the pandemic. And it's been so distressing to see people's responses, most education systems' responses to this, because most education systems have only focused on the disbenefit to the individual. It's really focused attention to the individuality, whereas it's screaming to me how important the social is for education and for learning. That's a kind of key point for me.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I suppose the third thing that I'd throw into that mix, if you want me to carry on talking on this theme, is that the pandemic has also, it's interesting. It's now, you're doing this interview now in July 2021. In a year ago, in July 2020, all the news, all the about education was about the unsupportable inequality of provision in mainstream schooling. So in Australia, the discussion was around the percentage of the population who did not have access to the internet, the schools that had no idea, no capacity, no training, no support to develop forms of blended learning, right? So, and at that time, a year ago, it was quite encouraging to see how the inequality of our societies was being exposed by the pandemic. Now, a year later, I think people may disagree with me, but I think there's much more accept that the inequality has become normalized again. So we're much more accepting of the inequality of provision. A year ago in England, school head teachers were being asked about making sure that children had access to the internet or computers at home. And the head teachers were saying, this is important, this is urgent, but have you got any food? Right? Right? Because the inequality of our societies is something that we learn to live with and become accustomed to and stop caring about. And the pandemic, the attention to schools in the pandemic over the year has seen a particular attention to the grotesque inequalities in our society and then the normalization of inequality as every day. So sitting here in July 2021 is a different story than if we'd have been talking a year ago, it seems to me.
Sure. And Julian, do you think that the school or universities as institutions with this picture you're describing of the pandemia are in a way crucial institutions to allow us think ourselves in a collective way? What you were saying about the individual phase of it, of online education, but also our relationships with digital media, digital platforms. Do you understand education, formal education or institutions as a proper way in order to build a more collective society or to face inequalities?
At the beginning of the pandemic in England, where I was then living, there was incredible interest in delivery people, low-paid carers, the way that society was suddenly exposed as a network of reciprocal relationships, of economically unfair interdependence. And at that time, there is a real interest in the large institutions of state as being the best way to ameliorate disadvantage. In England, of course, there's a national myth about the National Health Service, which is one of the first largest national health services, which is a good example of a state-run, state-led organization that offers the best, most equitable way of fairness for all, right? And at that time, I would say that schools were being asked deep questions about whether they were the best institutions for fairness, for social mobility, for meeting needs, right? So I think at that time, in some ways, schooling proved they're what holds society together. They were the places where families could come for help. They were the places that knew people. They were the places that understood individual needs. Everybody was recognized and seen and understood. Schools were society, if you like, right? And it showed at that time, in some ways, it was kind of interesting that the institutions of civil society, which have become so attacked in the last 30, 40 years under neoliberal capitalism, those institutions, schools, were suddenly some of the most inspiring ways that society could organize itself and be itself as a fair social existence. Now, a year later, I'm not sure that's true. Now, a year later, I think schooling has shown itself to be a mechanism for, you know, yet again, to be a mechanism for social stratification, for the core function of schools a year ago was seen to be exams. And keeping a year ago, when the pandemic was at its height, the key issues were, how can kids get accreditation, which they don't need for learning, but they need so they can be sorted in society? And how can kids be kept out of the home so parents can work? Like the 19th century vision of the school, which was that the parent could go to the factory, so that the child, right? And particularly we know now the terrible gendered inequality of the effect of the pandemic, the extremely pernicious, the terrible, the very unfair ways that women and women's labor has been devalued under the pandemic and all the rest of it, right? So in some ways, schooling, the pandemic proved that schools do a good job for society. They create the conditions, they're important for society. And in some ways, it was an opportunity for education, for civil society, and for the state to revalue what they want from their institutions. Now I'm not so sure what the value is. Now everybody wants to go back to normal. Well, what is normal but unfairness and inequality and lack of opportunity, right? What is, you know, our schools, will people remember that the school was the place that enabled them to get food, that the school was the place that looked after them? Will they remember that the school is the place where you meet people and where you're at your happiest with other people? Right? I don't know.
Julian, do you think that, getting back to Michael Apple that came to my mind when I listened to this, schools were society, do you think that this pandemic and this experience show us that schools can or could change society? Do you think we have this opportunity from schools and university, of course not alone, but to change somehow the way societies work through activism?
So part of me wants to say yes, but the other part of me would say, The institution which has perhaps become strongest under the pandemic is digital media and forms of digital culture. And digital culture is fantastic in so many ways, but essentially it individualizes and atomizes individuals as consumers. So you could ask yourself, if you were a middle-class parent of a child that enjoyed learning because of the social capital you've given them at home, you could ask them whether they need school anymore or whether they'd be better off on all the platforms to enable them to do better with their learning, that they could do better at maths. If they're on the maths platform, they could do more social science, you know what I mean? And those sorts of things. So you could argue that the pandemic threw up for contemporary society the challenge of socially organized civil institutions versus global oligopolies, where digital culture treats people as individual entities. I am not a prophet, and you know, if you get a prophet on the show, give me their address. But I mean that we don't know who's going to win. We don't know whether this challenge between individualized services of learning on digital platforms versus the collective sociality of school will win. We don't know. In different societies in the world, different economic interests will achieve, or obviously win in different, you know, that battle will play out in different kinds of ways. We know that that some societies, the individualized surveillance capitalism, which is so successful in delivering a limited vision of education, is going to win. And we know in other societies, it isn't. If I'm right that I painted this as alternative, like a battle between, if I'm right, and I'm obviously exaggerated on one level, if I'm right, the answer will lie somewhere in between. Right, because we never inherit, right? In other words, for some people in the world, school will become less important and the digital media will become more important. And in other societies, the reverse will be true and it will be unequal and unequally distributed, I would say.
Do you still think that digital literacies or media literacies are tools or methods that we have in order to struggle to face with all these struggles you are mentioning?
So the challenges of the increasingly digitalized society, the sort of stuff you might have talked about with Lucy Pangrazia, my colleague, or Neil Selwyn, pose a series of ethical, political, and educational challenges. And there's no question that literacy, some forms of digital literacy, are the best forms of critique that are available to us. Without forms of critical digital literacy or media literacy, whatever term you want to use, without ways of helping people reflect on the power structures which determine their communication, which determine their expressive capabilities, without this kind of reflexive critical understanding, it's very difficult to see how any form of political resistance will ever be constructed or developed. If education systems refuse to take on what I think is an ethical imperative to make the challenge of living in a digitally mediated world central to their curriculum, schooling will, I think, lose its fundamental ethical rationale. So the political rationale of education for democracy, or the political rationale of teaching people social responsibility, of citizenship, all the fundamental ways in which schools have been central to the vision of the body politic in the societies in which they live, whether that's a religious care, whether that's an indigenous responsibility to the land, whether that's a scientific commitment to progress, whatever the value system, schools have been fundamental to the ethical vision of education. There is an ethical need in digital culture to help people negotiate that, and digital literacy is at the forefront of that ethical response.
Can you give us some examples of how to do this, or what do we need to look at when we want to promote a critical digital and not only digital literacies in schools and university? And especially we can put the focus now on datification, but that's something you have been working on last year.
On datification.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would say transparency and accountability. A school is a place where data is produced about students. It always has been, actually, before the digital. Okay. What are the criteria by which you are known and by which you are measured? How can you influence that? How can you know about that? How can you have access to that? How can you challenge that? Right, very kind of what used to be very fundamental principles in exam accreditation, right? In curricula, how all knowledge is produced and represented. So the challenges of learning about how data is given meaning and interpreted has to be part of the curriculum. It has to be part of the pedagogy. So you can't judge and measure people without telling them how you are judging and measuring them, because otherwise you're a hypocrite as a teacher. Or not a hypocrite as an individual, but you're engaging in the practices of mystification, which you're trying to dismantle in the first place. Yeah? So the school itself as an institution needs to be transparent and accountable about the way that data about students is produced, just like the big tech companies are trying to make users accountable for their data. So the digital rights of the child, the European GDPR, there are various regulatory controls that aim to put people in charge of information about themselves. They don't succeed, but that's the aim. And you need to do that in a school at a micro level. And you need to teach children about the processes of datification. It needs to be part of the curriculum. You need to have media education as part of the curriculum. You need to have understanding about the way that children are known and measured and abstracted. And then we obviously need to know issues to do with misinformation, truthfulness, evidence. But I'm particularly thinking here of filter bubbles and misinformation and the new populism and things like that. All of those topics need to be part of a curriculum. But I'm saying that the practices of schooling and the content of schooling can't be held as separate entities, that you need, both need to be looked at together. You can't do one without the other. You can't introduce media literacy into a school that has cameras watching you go to the toilet. I mean, I'm exaggerating. I don't think they do that. Well, what do I know? But you need to know those things. And you need to know, if you put a doorbell in your front, your parents put a doorbell in that's part of the Amazon Ring network, that you're part of a surveillance culture and what the implications of that are. You need to bring your everyday life experiences into the school, and the school needs to make the everyday life experiences of living with data part of its curriculum.
Right. Julian, I wanted to ask you, because we are, as a research group, we are starting to have some projects in the line of datification. And what we face, or what we find when we talk with teachers or with school directors, it's a lot of fear, but because of lack of knowledge, right? So I would like to ask you if you have the chance to talk to one particular teacher or to a school director, why it's so important to start building, let's say like this, a data culture with open access or with starting to reflect the way that our data is being produced and analyzed and so on. What do you think?
So I know I'm going to have, part of the problem is that data on the whole is something that is done to schools rather than schools do. So a lot of local authorities or national state education systems demand data. It's a very hierarchical thing. So part of the difficulty is how can you tell a teacher or how can a school principal ideally, why would it be in their interest to make data the subject of schooling rather than the practice? So I can try and persuade people for ethical purposes. So I can try and persuade them about injustices. You can try and persuade schools to teach children about their rights. So schools that live in areas that are heavily policed, so areas of poverty or with high immigrant or minority populations, are always sensitive to political injustice. Because, and often in those schools, the principal or the teacher will feel it's part of their duty to help children negotiate everyday injustices. So part of the thing to do is to try to help build on individual injustices as systemic injustices. I can do that. We can do that. But what do you do in a school, in the average school, in an average area where nobody's terribly, you know, they don't know that they're being datafied. They've decided they don't really care because even if Google knows when they go to the toilet or when they're pregnant or whatever mysterious things Google knows about us that we don't even know ourselves, people have decided they don't really care about that because that's the bargain that they have with society. And that's a very difficult challenge facing all of us because we are all living in societies of increasing control. So the pandemic, to go back to the first part of our conversation, has helped the state increase its powers because it's made it, you know, because they're necessary in that kind of way. So how do you help? How do I help? Why would a teacher listen to me? Because I think learning about data is more important than something else that they think is important. I don't know the answer to that. I guess I only believe that rational discussion is the only way forward. I mean, you know what I mean? I think people will be persuaded at an individual level. The question is, in a way, you need education systems to make these matters valuable because then they will count. Like a teacher will not listen to me if they're more concerned about getting a qualification in geography or physics. If they think they've got to make a choice between teaching a child, I don't know, how a volcano works or how data works, right? That's the way that most discussions about education get framed, as a cost-benefit choice between values. So why do we live in a society where learning how a volcano works, I mean, excuse the example, is more important than how Amazon Ring works? I don't know how we've got to that state of affairs. I feel useless. I feel inadequate, that I can't make more of a difference. Right. I think the things that I think are important for the health of our democracy, for the health of our society, for the happiness of individuals, are more important But I'm not the first person in history to think that they know, you know, that they have a different sense of values which count. All you can do as an academic is try and persuade people to present the arguments and to hope that people come on board and that that changes the culture.
I share a research interest with you, Julian, which is this you introduced before, this connecting learning in and out schools, universities, even workplaces. So would you say this can be connected? I mean, if we start worrying about how Amazon works or how Google works or how Instagram or TikTok works, bringing this into the classrooms, into the universities, can help to introduce these very important social topics that we are not addressing in schools and universities, because we're talking about ratification, but we could talk also about gender inequality or migration or many, many kinds of inequalities we are not addressing in schools and universities as the leaf that needs to be more addressed. So do you think that connecting the schools and or curriculums with everyday lives can get us to this direction? Is that one of the reasons?
I think in places where forms of social injustice are to the fore, so in areas where Black Lives Matter was a curriculum issue for young people, in areas where sustainability and climate disaster and climate inequality is, you know, in these circumstances, there's a chain reaction that people start looking at vested interests. And as soon as you start looking at vested interests, you start having to look at digital media, because digital media is at the cutting edge of the way that so many vested interests are mediated and maintained and communicated. And then suddenly the door is open to these kinds of discussions, right? You can't, you know, so children and teachers in many parts of the world are really vexed by climate change. They're living in physically difficult circumstances, right? Their economies are affected. Immediately, this opens the possibility for making those kind of connections from people's experiences across domains, across academic fields, the kind of connectedness that you were just talking about, Raquel. So I think that's always a constructive way to build reform movements. The vested interests of everyday life become the material for academic study.
Great, Julian. I have one more question. Then Raquel would close the dialogue. I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, do you think that we are facing or living an epistemology crisis in the way that we build and we construct knowledge, and recognizing the way that digital media and internet as a whole is producing and disseminating information? And If you agree with my theory or my thought, how can academia and science could work in order to change this situation or to transform it, right?
So I think I don't know, this is an empirical fact, but I would guess that everybody at every time in history is always living through an epistemological crisis. So I think if you were in the 19th century and you were worried about the humanities and the growth of science or the growth of industrialization, I think if you were in the 20th century and you were worried about globalization, I think in the 21st century we're worried about the digital. I think every society is always facing challenges about what counts as knowledge, what's politically valued knowledge, what counts, and how can people organize, how can people do good? I think these are pretty constant questions. I do agree, because I don't know any better, that the digital seems to pose questions about scale and management of modern society that seem very new, that seem unparalleled, that the possibilities for surveillance, for AI, are facing very new and deep challenges. So I do think that the notion of the democratic citizen, the sovereign individual who makes decisions, is challenged by digital technologies and the determinism of preemptive data analytics and all the rest of it in ways that we haven't come across before. And as our societies continue to grow in complexity and scale, you know, the simple volume of population living under stress, the need for new methods of control and order are going to become more and more apparent. You know, that 7 billion people, less and less water. Do you know what I mean? It's not, you don't want a free for all. So, schools, formal education that will always be at the forefront of these kinds of debates about what counts. Sometimes education will be in the service of management of technologies of control. And after all, you could say that the brilliance, the ingenuity of digital culture has not led to greater freedom for individuals, but to greater opportunities for social control and wealth by a few. You know, so we are all complicit in this already. If you're asking me what would be the what role can we play in a progressive politics, which is what I think you're asking me, then we are already engaged in that. And the kind of discussion, this kind of initiative, the kind of work that people do, there's always going to be debate and discussion, and some societies will come to different arrangements than others. But you couldn't, you know, there are some societies where we can't have this kind of discussion, where the kind of freedom to have this kind of openness wouldn't be available to us. You know, the sheer mass of numbers and the resource challenge is going to make the possibilities for progressive liberal opposition much more difficult, it seems to me, than at other periods of time.
We don't want to close this episode without asking you a question. As I told you before this talk, last time we met, you recommended me some books that I read with attention and I enjoyed very much, not only academic books, but also novels. And I wonder if you can share this with our listeners. So maybe some books, some documentaries, some movie, I don't know. But what will you suggest us to read, watch, I don't know, to think about what's going on, the challenges we have now?
Oh, I should have prepared for this. Well, we live in going back to Ezekiel's question just now, I mean, we live in a time of incredible flowering of films, television programs, books, writing. There's no shortage of debate. The question is whether it's just individualized consumption of debate or whether it makes a difference. I mean, there's so much good I honestly, you're just good entertainment, good writing. Good scholarship. And I haven't come up with a single example as I'm answering this question because you've floored me.
You can send it later and we'll share it to the network.
I'll send you my top five. But I do I think it's an interesting question that the we're not short of scholars, we're not short of brilliant minds, we're not short of creative work, we're not short of you know what I mean, there's the of ways of reflecting on our condition. The question is, how dissatisfied are we, or are we not really that dissatisfied? It's just that we're not in charge. I don't know the answer to that one.
Wonderful. Great ending. Well, Julian, we wanted to thank you very much. It was a great end to our talk, to our dialogue. Hope you're fine, that you are with good health, and let's hope to have the opportunity to see you around here in Spain, or maybe we go into England soon. And well, thank you very much again for the opportunity to talk.
No, thank you very much for the questions and the opportunity. And it's lovely to reconnect with you, Raquel, and to meet you, Ezequiel. And I also echo, you know, the opportunity, you know, if there's a chance to connect and do some work or projects or meetings, even just obviously the obvious, just the natural human experience of sitting down and talking about books would just be a lovely opportunity. But so thank you very much indeed as well.
Oh,
yes. Thank you, Julian.
Okay. Ciao.